Today is May the 12th, 2021. Just a reminder, the federal tax filing deadline is Monday, May the 17th, next week. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, that's the Progressive Radio Network, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. The U.S. government declared a regional emergency over fuel pipeline hack. The Colonial Pipeline, the largest fuel pipeline system in the United States, was subjected to a highly sophisticated cyber attack on Friday. The United States government declared a regional emergency after a key pipeline was hit by a cyber attack. The Colonial Pipeline, the largest fuel pipeline system in America, was subjected to a highly sophisticated cyber attack on Friday, drawing attention to the threat of hacking of business and government infrastructures. The Colonial Pipeline Company, which operates a pipeline that carries gasoline, diesel, fuel, and natural gas along a 5,500-mile path from Texas to New Jersey, released a statement confirming reports that ransomware hackers had hit its network. In response, Colonial Pipeline says it shut down parts of the pipeline operation in an attempt to contain the threat. The incident represents one of the largest disruptions of American critical infrastructure by hackers in history. The supply line, which carries 45% of the East Coast supply of diesel, gasoline, and jet fuel, still remains largely shut. On Sunday, the U.S. government enacted the emergency declaration in order to keep the supply lines open as fears of shortages rose. The declaration allows the fuel to now be transported by road to the affected states. The disruption has affected 18 states, which have been granted temporary hours of service waiver for transporting gasoline, diesel, jet fuel, and other refined petroleum products. It includes Alabama, Arkansas, District of Columbia, Delaware, Florida, Georgia, Kentucky, Louisiana, Maryland, Mississippi, New Jersey, New York, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, and Virginia. It also provides regulatory relief to commercial motor vehicle operations that are part of the emergency support efforts. The attack has also led to fuel prices rising on Monday as Brent crude climbed 1%. The Colonial Pipeline hack is a new extreme for ransomware. The threat of cyber attacks on a pipeline represents a significant threat to the civilian power grid. You have a real ability to impact the electric system in a broad way by cutting the supply of natural gas. Colonial Pipeline's short public statement says that it has launched an investigation into the nature and scope of this incident, which is ongoing. Reuters reports investigators suspect that a ransomware group known as DarkSide may be responsible. The Colonial Pipeline shutdown comes in the midst of an escalating ransomware epidemic. Hackers have digitally crippled and extorted hospitals, hacked law enforcement databases, and threatened to publicly out police informants and paralyze municipal systems in Baltimore and Atlanta. Ransomware operators have increasingly had industrial victims in their sight in recent years. In the Colonial Pipeline case, it's not yet clear if the hackers bridged that gap to systems that could have actually allowed them to meddle with the physical state of the pipeline or create potentially dangerous physical conditions. Merely gaining broad access to the IT network could be cause enough for the company to shut down the pipeline's operation as a safety precaution. The operator did the right thing in this case as a response to the events. Once you can no longer assure positive control over the environment and clear visibility into operations, then you need to shut it down. Ransomware intrusions attacking operational technology systems are far more rare than those that merely target IT networks. A growing number of ransomware groups working to infect the OT systems that control industrial and manufacturing equipment with the aim of totally disrupting their victims' operations. Organizations increasingly connect those more sensitive networks to the internet for efficiency and remote automation, and a spat of vulnerabilities in the VPNs companies use to remotely connect to those networks have left them more exposed. These gangs figured out, here's a bunch of internet-facing devices. Here are vulnerabilities that give us access to them, and here are the IP ranges of addresses of big industrial companies. Any proposed solution will require participation from multiple government agencies and must contend with the fact that many of the most aggressive hacking groups appear to be located in countries like Russia, whose governments rarely prosecute and often collaborate with the hackers in their midst. That leaves critical infrastructure providers in the United States with little choice but to bolster their defenses against an onslaught of loosely organized criminal hackers whose disruptive ambitions are only growing. The Federal Trade Commission recommends to Congress ways to expand consumers' repair options. The FTC, by a vote of 4-0, released to Congress its long-awaited report on how manufacturers limit product repairs. The Nixing the Fix report details a host of repair restrictions, especially those imposed by mobile phone and car manufacturers. The anti-competitive practices covered by the FTC range from limited availability of spare parts and diagnostic software to designs that make repairs more difficult than they need to be. In a new report to Congress, the Federal Trade Commission identifies numerous types of repair restrictions, such as using adhesives that makes parts difficult to replace, limiting the availability of spare parts, and making diagnostic software unavailable. The report's findings, including that there is scant evidence to support manufacturers' justification for repair restrictions, are primarily based on responses to the Commission's request for public comments and empirical research issued in connections with its July 2019 workshop, Nixing the Fix, a workshop on repair restrictions. The report explores means of expanding consumers' repair options and how the Commission could assist in that expansion, consistent with statutory authority. In addition, the Commission notes that it stands ready to work with lawmakers, either at the state or federal level, to ensure that consumers have choices when they need to repair products that they purchase and own. Congress directed the FTC to issue the report, noting that it is aware of the FTC's ongoing review of how manufacturers, in particular, mobile phone and car manufacturers, may limit repairs by consumers and repair shops, and how those limitations may increase costs, limit choice, and impact consumers' right under the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act. Congress specifically directed the FTC to include recommendations on how to best address these problems. In response, the FTC stated that in the report, they want to develop new laws and rules surrounding repairs, but it also wants better enforcement of existing legislation like the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act. While debates around right to repair rules in the European Union have tended to focus on the environmental impact of sending broken devices to landfills, the FTC's report leads with the impact they have on people. It says repair restrictions are bad for consumers when they can't easily repair their devices, and that these may place a greater financial burden on communities of color and lower-income Americans. Independent repair shops also suffer as a result of repair restrictions, disproportionately affecting small businesses owned by people of color. The timing of the report is also important. Not only has it arrived during an unprecedented period of working from home and remote learning, where teleworking equipment is more important than ever, but it also coincides with a global semiconductor shortage that makes buying new equipment particularly difficult. Combined, they make it particularly important to be able to repair our existing devices. According to the FTC, manufacturers are guilty of using numerous tactics that make it difficult for customers and independent businesses to repair their products. And here's a list from the FTC report. Product designs that complicate or prevent repair. Unavailability of parts and repair information. Designs that make independent repairs less safe. Policies or statements that steer consumers to manufacturer repair networks. Application of patent rights and enforcement of trademarks. Disparagement of non-OEM parts and independent repair. Software locks and firmware updates and end-user license agreements. Manufacturers have long argued that they have legitimate reasons for at least some of these restrictions. These include protecting their intellectual property, cybersecurity, and possible safety risks associated with independent repairers opening up our devices and replacing failed parts. But the FTC isn't buying it at all. There is scant evidence to support manufacturers' justifications for repair restrictions. The report states, adding that the majority of manufacturers' explanations for repair restrictions are not supported by the record. Apple, one of the companies most frequently criticized for its repair policies, has made moves to make spare parts and diagnostic tools more available to independent repair shops in recent years. But critics say the new policies still give the company too much power over independent businesses. The CEO of repair specialist iFixit welcomed the FTC report. This is a great step in the right direction. The bipartisan report shows that the FTC knows that the market has not regulated itself and is committing to real action. With findings submitted to Congress, the question now is how to make repairing devices easier. The FTC's report makes several suggestions, including the introduction of new legislation to address repair restrictions and open repair markets. While it also encourages manufacturers to self-regulate, the FTC concedes that the broad range of industries and products involved would make that a challenge. The FTC suggests consumers could be given more information on how repairable devices are, such as with repairability scores like those recently introduced in France. But the FTC also wants consumers to report when manufacturers aren't obeying existing rules surrounding repairs as described in an accompanying post in their website. Let's say you took a product to an independent repair shop to fix or maintain it. Then later you go to the product manufacturer for repair, but one not related to the earlier fix. If that repair is covered by your warranty, and if your warranty hasn't expired, the manufacturer can't refuse to make the repair. If you're told that your warranty was voided or that it will be voided because of the independent repair, they want to hear about it. Report it to the FTC at reportfraud.ftc.gov. The FTC report follows efforts by several U.S. states as well as the European Parliament vote last year to expand right to repair rules. The chip shortage is making cars more expensive. But that's not slowing down buyers. New cars are getting more expensive thanks to the global semiconductor shortage, and the price of used cars is going up too. About 13% of people who bought a new car in the United States in April paid above sticker price, according to the director of Insights at Edmunds. Last year, only 8% of buyers paid more. New vehicle prices have been on the rise for a while now, but the shortage is only worsening the trend. Automakers are temporarily shutting down production lines around the world. The chips that they are able to source are going into the most popular new vehicles, the ones that make the most money. To make matters worse, demand for new cars and trucks is increasing, leading to markups. This has pushed more consumers to the used vehicle market, which is driving up prices there too. General Motors said this week that its new full-size trucks cost 10% more than they did last year, and its full-size SUV cost more than 20% more. Ford's new vehicles shot up in price by $1,900 more than the average industry increase in 2019, but overall sales are way up. Prices are just soaring. And as high as the prices go, it seems like it doesn't really deter people. Prices will likely keep climbing as a chip shortage keeps thinning supply. Automakers like Ford and Volkswagen have said they expect to take an even worse hit to production this quarter. Ford will only make half as many cars as it originally expected, and the company said this week during its quarterly investor call that they are sure in crisis mode. Ford will only make half as many cars as it originally expected, the company said this week during its quarterly investor call. And Volkswagen said that we are for sure in crisis mode. Some, like GM, have said they think lower output won't be a huge problem, but the supply of new cars will further dry up for other reasons. Up until now, dealers were working with a cushion of inventory that was built up before the production halts began. The summer months are typically when seasonal demand for new cars really starts to rise. And this is no typical summer this year. Millions of people received stimulus checks, and vaccines for the coronavirus have finally been widely rolled out. I imagine this year will be even higher because people are itching to go out and go out on the road and going back to school. The price of a new car was already increasing in the United States as consumers flocked to larger SUVs and trucks with more advanced features, so the chip shortage has supercharged the trend. There are other contributing factors, though. Higher sticker prices became easier to swallow once automakers and banks started offering loans with 84-month and 96-month terms. Those extra-long financing options got even more palatable when automakers started offering 0% financing deals to boost sales early in the pandemic. The high demand for new cars could be tested as more automakers are starting to sacrifice certain features due to the chip shortage. Some Dodge Ram pickups will no longer have an intelligent rearview mirror as a standard feature, and Nissan is dropping navigation systems in many of its vehicles. GM decided in March that it will keep making its most popular trucks without a particular module that normally increases fuel economy, meaning the trucks will pollute more and guzzle even more money. Low supply, high demand, and it's only going to get worse near term. But there is already such an inventory crush and so many people buying that these changes might not matter much. As you get close to a vehicle purchase, and people don't drive different cars all the time, they may not be savvy enough to know what should or shouldn't be there. With wages relatively stagnant, Cox Automotive Executive says they are worried that this will make it even harder for average buyers to get into newer, safer cars. The average household income used to be enough to buy a new car, but it's not anymore. But it's more like a 14-year-old used car. It's the opposite of what Henry Ford envisioned. People who make the cars can't afford the new cars, right? But used car prices are going up too, aided in part by the chip shortage. Higher average selling prices for new cars paired with increasingly low inventory means more people are turning to the used car market, which is causing more competition between buyers. Used car prices were already on the rise for a few other reasons. Rental companies typically sell into the used car market, but they dumped much of their inventory last year as the travel industry flatlined. Now with travel recovering as more people get vaccinated, rental companies are bidding against used car buyers to get some of those vehicles back, which is pushing up prices. Newly off-lease cars are another usual source for the used car market, but automakers have been encouraging some customers to extend their leases because of the winnowing new car inventory. A decline in repossessions during the pandemic also weakened the supply of used cars. Sedans actually rebounded a bit, but it won't last. The chip shortage has exacerbated many of these pricing trends, but it may have temporarily reversed one that previously seemed irreversible. According to data compiled by Ward's Intelligence, sedans actually picked up a few percentage points of overall market share in the United States in April. That could mean some buyers are considering a much different middle ground option between fighting to buy the new trucks and SUVs that are in demand and scouring the used market, settling for a smaller traditional new car. While that trend would be better for pedestrian safety and greenhouse gas emissions in the long run, it's not likely to stick. U.S. automakers have all but abandoned sedans, and even the foreign automakers who have been happy to fill that vacuum for the last few years are also focusing more on pickup trucks and SUVs. Long term, consumers are just willing to pay more for bigger, more well-equipped vehicle. The one thing they are not willing to do, they will not go from a sport utility vehicle to a sedan. That is just dead on arrival. Microsoft shelves Windows 10X. Microsoft has been trying to build a lighter version of Windows for more than 10 years without much success. The latest effort, Windows 10X, has reportedly now been shelved in favor of improving Windows 10 instead. According to people familiar with the company's plans, Microsoft will not be shipping Windows 10X this year, and the operating system as you know it today will likely never arrive. The company has shifted resources to Windows 10, and 10X is on the back burner for now. For about a decade, Microsoft has been trying to modernize Windows in various ways. We've seen Windows RT, Windows 10S, and now Windows 10X. The question becomes if there really is a future for anything other than traditional Windows 10. Microsoft said during their last earnings call that there were 1.3 billion active devices are running the operating system each month, and with that context in mind, does that really need to be a light version of the operating system? Windows 10X will no longer ship this year, and the operating system will likely never arrive in its current form. Microsoft had originally been planning to deliver Windows 10X, a more lightweight and simplified version of Windows. It was designed to position Windows 10X as more of a Chrome operating system competitor. Windows 10X included a simplified interface, an updated start menu without live tiles, multitasking improvements, and a special app container for performance and security. Microsoft's overall goal with 10X was to create a stripped-back, streamlined, and modern cloud power version of Windows. Over the past year, there has been a big increase in demand for regular Windows laptops. Despite a global chip shortage, the PC market hasn't slowed down during the pandemic. Microsoft has directly benefited with increased Windows revenue. Windows OEM revenue grew by 10% in the recent quarter, reflecting strong consumer PC demand. Windows non-pro OEM revenue also grew by 44%. There are now 1.3 billion active Windows 10 devices, according to Microsoft. That's a huge amount of existing devices. And it appears Microsoft is now focused on improving the core of Windows 10 instead of delivering a new variant. Microsoft has been gradually working on improving the user interface of Windows 10 with new systems icons and File Explorer improvements. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, Post-COVID Return to Office, Part 5.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, technology, and, yes, the workplace. Now, we've been going through a series that's more about the workplace than it is about computers and technology. But this is an important thing that I want to address because I don't know that there are a lot of people addressing this on the radio. This is a six-part series. It's my post-COVID outlook on work. Yes, I know we're going through this and we're not really on the other side of this, but I want you to be prepared We've gone through the business side decisions that have to be made. We've talked about staying home or going back and you want to, going back and you don't want to. This week, we're talking about staying home and you don't want to. Now, next week, we're talking about the hybrid model, and we're going to be talking about some of the things that are going on there, but that's next week. Right now, staying home and you don't want to. An IT executive, actually, it was a fintech CEO, financial technology. He recently said that everybody is sick of their family. I'm going to say this real quick. You may be sick of your family, but my suggestion here, his approach that he said in front of his entire board of directors in public, it's actually kind of sad to reflect on him and what his home life is like. If you're experiencing this, and especially for him, the fact that he would so vocally say this and say everybody is clamoring to get back, well, it's wrong. I would suggest marriage and family counseling. There is a truth to what he said, that many people have found the stressors very tough. However, many people have found a way through to the other side, or they have stuck with it, or they've adapted, whatever. You are a rarity. If you are going to be staying home and you don't want to, you're a rarity in that, because almost 70% of workers surveyed would seek a remote work option today. Now, I will admit, I personally struggled with a work from home model while I was in a previous role. Now, that was working from home one day a week. This was something where I was out of touch with the fast-paced movers and shakers of the office. It was flying along, and there were contributing factors that just made it almost miserable. My current role is different. I communicate worldwide to people in our company. I rarely got FaceTime when I was in the office with people, and sometimes I would have conference calls with coworkers that were 2, 3, 4 desks away. We've got, 5 people in this call, and I can see 3 of them. The other 2 are on the other side of the cube farm over off to my left or my right, whatever it is. It's like, why are we doing this? Let's go into a conference room. Let's see each other. But that's kind of the corporate culture of the company that I'm working at. That's okay. And I adapted to that. So my current role, when all of us get shifted home, 95% of us get shifted home about a year ago, I easily adapted. I want you to know that companies have realized that they can increase bottom line profits by closing the offices and leaving you at home. The upside of that is you have zero commute. You're making more money now by the fact that you're not spending it on gasoline and wear and tear on your car. And, you in the last year and a half or so, you haven't had to replace your car. So realize that there's a good amount of benefit that you're getting. What was your commute before? Half an hour each way, 45 minutes each way. You now have an hour and a half, whatever it is that's been returned to you and your life to use how you want. Now, I do want to make sure that you have a healthy work-life balance. I want you to enjoy what family time you have. I want you to make sure you have that escapist time. If you are struggling with that whole staying at home and you don't want to situation, maybe it's because you aren't taking a break when you move from work to life. That is shifting on that seesaw, that work-life balance. You shift from one end to the other. Maybe take 15 minutes and look at cute cat videos on YouTube or something like that. Make sure that you close the door. You get that silence time, whatever it is, that escapist time that you used to get in your commute. I still want you to work to engage via voice and in person. I want to find ways to encourage your employer to allow for engagements in person. whether it's office parties or maybe you get to meet up with people on a regular basis for work, try to find ways to bridge that gap. If you're struggling, look, web conferencing. Yes, get dressed like you're going to work and you turn on that webcam and you encourage your coworkers. It maybe say all the meetings you're going to participate in on Monday. We want everybody to dress up like they're going into the office. Yeah, we know that even though I say this, I practice what I preach. I get dressed up like I'm going into the office. I know a lot of people have been staying in their pajamas. Look, get dressed up. Get on to the web conference. See everybody in person. Maybe that will help you bridge that gap there with communicating with the office and the people there. There's a lot of different options there. I want you to understand that you've already been doing it for a year. Maybe you can do it for longer. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. There has been much talk about the digital divide. There really has been no true measure what areas of the country has no or very slow internet access. Some think it's along racial lines. Others think there is a major divide between rural and urban population centers. Although it is not foolproof, but a reasonably accurate metric may be how homework gap may actually be the key to identify the actual geographic areas of the digital divide. Schools across the country during the past year of distance learning have had access to important data on who has access to broadband and who doesn't. There was a major shutdown in March of last year due to the coronavirus pandemic. School districts across the country scrambled to put in place a remote learning plan. They acquired computing equipment, if necessary, for each student to access learning tools remotely. Educators were able to put together a map to determine where broadband was available and where it wasn't. A major problem was that pockets of students throughout each school district lack access to broadband service or even cellular LTE service. The trick was figuring out where those dead spots were and how to get students connected. For students who could get cellular service but who lacked internet service at home, schools provided mobile hotspots. But for those whom access was simply not available at their homes, students could access the school's Wi-Fi network from the school's parking lot or schoolyards. Data should be readily available from each school mapping internet access of each student. With this knowledge, it identifies an extra level of support to students who were disconnected. But beyond supporting students, that information being collected by schools across the country could prove useful when addressing the problem of the digital divide. It's a significant gap. The Federal Communications Commission estimates that 14.5 million people still lack access to broadband internet, while Broadband Now, which tracks internet service and pricing, puts the figure of unconnected Americans at around 42 million. Hey, this is all guesswork without any supporting data. Instead of guessing, why not just use the information collected at the schools? School districts across the state were able to feed the information they gathered on online access and attendance to state officials. Those details were critical as legislators tried to figure out how to help schools during the pandemic and where to direct federal funds. The homework gap is a subset of a much larger digital divide that exists between people with and people without access to high-speed internet. For millions of Americans, the digital divide exists because they live in rural parts of the country where broadband infrastructure simply isn't available. For other families in rural and suburban markets, broadband service may be available, but unaffordable. The problems with the current system for collecting the data stems from the fact that the data isn't granular enough, so it may say an area is covered with broadband when in fact it could only be one address with the access. This is where policymakers could find help from the year-long experiment on distance learning that schools across the country were forced to undergo. If school districts and others working at the local level were collecting and mapping areas to access basic broadband and computing needs, it could provide a wealth of information that could be fed into databases mapping the digital divide. schools are proving to be very valuable partners in figuring out the needs of the community, including where broadband does and does not exist in their communities. Schools are uniquely positioned to be able to collect data about students' broadband access and to marry that data with other information about students. This includes not just whether service exists, but also service quality and the types of applications being used over that connection. Schools also already collect demographic and socioeconomic data, which can be useful in tracking and analyzing the root causes of why students may not have service. Together, this gives school districts the ability to track the digital divides of students over time in order to give state and federal policy holders a snapshot of the need, as well as the cost and service quality of the broadband access that's available in the local community. Before the pandemic, many school officials had no clue who their local wireless or broadband service providers were. It's important that schools recognize that gathering this data and helping families connect to the internet should be part of their outreach in this new age of distance learning. It's become very apparent now that broadband is a critical information infrastructure asset. Spoofing does not serve the interest of the general public. The Federal Communications Commission recently announced new efforts that would require phone service providers to be held accountable for allowing robocalls. There is a steady increase in automated phone calls. Some of these calls come from legitimate businesses. However, others often look to scam consumers for money or private information. Studies estimate that users receive 4.1 billion robocalls just in the month of January of this year. While some businesses have received fines, most calls are still untraceable, which means that the Federal Trade Commission and the FCC cannot regulate them. As a result, the FCC announced the creation of the Robocall Mitigation Database to regulate robocalls by placing pressure on phone companies instead of the state. The database is an extension of the Telephone Robocall Abuse Criminal Enforcement and Deterrence Act, otherwise with the abbreviation of TRACED, T-R-A-C-E-D. This act was signed into law in December of 2019. The act initially demanded that voice providers develop technology to authenticate calls and expand FCC authority over robocall providers. Last year, the FCC passed several measures that would help set the standard for phone providers, including increasing the fines for intentional robocalls violations to $10,000 per violation and removing the need for the FCC to warn a potential violator about the fee before issuing it. Robocalls have been the top of consumer complaint lists for years. The Federal Communications Commission has been trying to stop them. A federal initiative called Stir and Shaken aims to block unwanted calls before they ever get to someone's phone. Stir and Shaken is a technology designed to reduce robocalls and illegal phone number spoofing. Stir stands for Secure Telephone Identity Revisited, while Shaken stands for Secure Handling of Asserted Information Using Tokens. The FCC sent Stir and Shaken notices to carriers in July of 2017. In November of 2018, carriers were told to implement it within a year. The December 2019 deadline came and went, so Congress passed the TRACED Act to force the FCC to get moving. Because of that bill, by the end of June, all carriers are supposed to be on board. What's taking so long? Stir and Shaken should have a bigger impact than previous efforts to stop unwanted calls. The Do Not Call Registry was supposed to have stopped legitimate businesses following the law from making calls. It didn't stop the bad actors from making calls. Instead, it provided them a list of telephone numbers to use. Stir and Shaken works like this. When someone is making a call, let's say from Brooklyn, their carrier verifies their number. As the call travels to its destination, any intermediate carrier along the way also verify the number. Finally, the phone company of the person on the receiving end of the call also signs off, allowing the call to go through. Phone companies will have until September of this year to register their anti-robocall efforts, including adopting stir and shaken protocols. The process has one major drawback. If there's a break in the chain at any stage along the way, in that moment, the robocaller can change the number of origin, allowing spoof calls where the identity of the call is hidden to get through. A robocall mitigation database lists 428 carriers. Right now, only 14 say they're fully implemented, stir and shaken. If someone's phone company doesn't get certified, other carriers using stir and shaken will be required to block calls from everyone that provider serves starting in September. Many smaller phone companies are struggling because stir and shaken won't work on their older systems, especially those that use copper wiring. It's still going to be a problem for rural areas. A real challenge are people that have traditional landlines. Stir and shaken also provides hope that enforcement will be more effective than in the past. Over the last 5 years, the FCC has fined robocallers more than $387 million, but was only able to collect $25,000 of that amount. Even as a new system is implemented, scammers are looking for weak spots. Robocalls will continue, but hopefully not at the levels they are now. In the press release, FCC acting chairwoman wrote the following: "Protecting consumers from scammers that use robocall and spoofing tools is a top priority. To succeed, we not only need an all-hands-on-deck response from the government, but we need industry's commitment and focus. Our message to providers is clear. Certify under penalty of perjury the steps you are taking to stop illegal robocalls, or we will block your calls." So let me ask this question. Why are we trying to solve the problem with preserving the ability to do spoofing? This does not serve the general welfare of the public. The simplest solution is to ban carriers from offering spoofing of any kind. Of course, this will result in loss of revenues for the carriers. Not allowing any kind of spoofing will also impact politicians and nonprofit organizations. However, they can still be able to make phone calls, but they can be readily identified. What are they hiding by using a false phone number in the call ID? Spoofing to hide their real number. Presenting Marty Winston, All Hands on Tech, Into the Sunset.
Hey, everybody. Today is going to be just a little bit different, and let me begin with an apology. I thought our report today would be, hey, sport, what happened to my ports, about how things like the Microsoft Surface, the Google Pixel, and so on, don't have the usual ports and so on. But there's something else. I've been on here just about every week for, something like 6 years now, and that won't be happening. I'm going to cut back. I'm not going away entirely. I'm not quitting. I'm not retired. I have to change some of my directions, and let me explain that. The News Tips Bulletin, which is how Joe and Hank and I met, has been a weekly bulletin, I guess is nothing else to call it, a publication, mostly by email, that for more than 40 years has gone out to working press people, and including your producers. I'm the only guy who ever wrote a word in it, so that's my publication. I'm the editor. News Tips Bulletin, if you've heard News Tips mentioned, well, it's kind of synonymous, and sometimes with me. That's not the point. The point is News Tips Bulletin will not be publishing anymore after the end of June, and it won't be weekly anymore after last Monday's issue. I have to turn attentions elsewhere, and that's part of what I want to explain, but I'm not fully allowed to explain. As you've heard in these reports, I've spent a lot of time looking into countermeasures to coronavirus and other infections. We've followed down a lot of tech, some of which turned out to be, unfortunately, bogus. That's the best word I can use. It's not that they were trying to defraud anybody, at least not most of the time. Most of the time, they just didn't know any better. And that's where my new direction kind of started. I was able to find out smarter answers. I talked the the guys, the chief scientist at Oak Ridge National Lab who did months-long supercomputer modeling of the virus and how it happened and how it communicated from one place to another and what factors were present at the time and everything about the emotions of people. And wonderfully rich, deep data, lots and lots of concurrence, occurrence, everything you've ever learned about that you wanted to compare, they had there. They were able to look at it. And when I got him a lovely, lovely, life-changing call, we talked about things like what was the real place to protect people. And it wasn't the spaces they were in. It was getting the germs to stop in their path on the way to the two places on their faces, the nose and the mouth, where infection, where contagion is most likely to occur. Those are ACE2 enzyme sites, receptor sites. And when the virus touches there, it triggers a bradykinin peptide storm. And if I sound medical, it's only because I read up on it. Believe me, that is not my background. I do, as you, have some background as a geek. I do understand how to make things work and to take a look at things that do work and figure out how they work, why they work, and just as often, why they don't and where the problem is. Anyway, that's been 6 years with you guys. And in looking at the mechanisms of all those almost 100 pieces of technology that claimed to fight coronavirus and finding nothing I was happy with in any of it. Well, I began talking to a company near here, and it was an argument at first. That's the only way I can put it. They had designed something that I saw just working backwards, and I eventually was able to show them that, yes, it's working backwards. They redesigned it. To their credit, they redesigned it. They didn't let it out until they had corrected that. That's going to hit the market any time now. I'm guessing maybe July, and coronavirus is going to be long, and other viruses is going to be long, much longer than that. Let's not worry about the pandemic surge. Let's think about long-term needs and solutions. Anyway, they listened, and he said, you know, if we'd come out with the way we intended to come out, we would have been embarrassed. We want to do what you want to do, and that's to stop the virus from infecting people. And I have been consulting to them for a while now. I think it's going to be a closer relationship, a more official relationship in the near future. And because that requires so much time, I'll be doing a lot more than you might expect. I'm doing engineering design. Am I qualified? Probably not, but it's working for me and it's working for them. I'm doing some help with the marketing. Am I qualified? Maybe, maybe not, but so far, it's making sense. And as long as we work together and make progress, as long as we make things happen, and as long as there's a chance, this is the important part, as long as there's a chance at what I'm doing, what they're putting their resources behind me to help make happen, as long as there's a chance that that will save lives in the long term, that will reduce or eliminate sickness in the long term, I'm going to do it. Folks, I'm 73 years old. I've had Social Security for years. It's not a lot of money, but it is enough for me to say I'm retired if I ever really was retired. And this means I'm going to go a much longer time before that'll be the case. But it is fun. It is rewarding. And I can't tell you how intriguing it is to know that I can conceptualize something, define it, make it happen, bring it to the marketplace, and have it absolutely, effectively change the outcome of any new round of disease. It's personally rewarding. I can't put it any other way. As a result of that time commitment, as a result of needing to put my attention on that, I won't be able to put nearly as much attention here. So I won't be here every week anymore. Hank might want to rerun some older segments he thinks will interest you, and that's fine with me. But overall, I'm going to be in here less often. When I am, it's going to be for one of two reasons. Either because there is something out there that can impact you that I think you want and need and deserve to know about. Or because I've had hands-on products that I think, again, you're going to want to know about one way or the other. You know, I've had Hall of Shame as well as Hall of Fame issues during this show. So let's go with this. First, to Hank, to Joe, to everybody here, my thanks for allowing my voice to come through the air with you guys for the last 6+ years. And to those of you who listen, and especially to those of you who listen and respond, my special thanks. It makes this worth doing. I once wrote an April Fool's Construction Project article about a one-station intercom with privacy switch. It was for people who wanted to talk to themselves but didn't always want to listen. Sometimes that's what radio feels like. You push the button and you talk. Is anybody out there? Some of you have let me know that. Yeah, you're out there, you're paying attention, and you're calling me to task. And that is wonderful. That is absolutely the way it should be. Not just a monologue, but a conversation. And if I'm not here, that's fine. You have Joe, you have Ben, you have Hank, you have others here with whom you can have your own conversations. Please, please do that. This is an honorific. You are geeks, guys. You gals, too. You are geeks. You understand the technology of the world, and it's fascinating. Stay with that. Don't be afraid to share it. Help your neighbors. Help each other. Help yourself. And help progress. Keep going forward. Until I'm back again, and even if I'm never back again, you have my respect for doing that task. And now, a phrase I won't be saying for a while. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Marty. Marty's not retiring, at least not yet. He will be devoting time on a new job. I expect that when he has an issue that challenges his intellect, we'll be hearing from him. We wish you well, Marty, on this new challenge. And just remember Einstein's 3 rules for work. And in ham radio vernacular, 73. The 45th Trenton Computer Festival, the original personal computer festival, was virtual this year. It took place on March the 20th, 2021. It was a 100% virtual event via Zoom teleconferencing. There were talks and forums via Zoom during the course of the day, and there were 10 simultaneous event tracks. Jerry Foster, CTO and co-founder, Plex Systems delivered the TCF 2021 keynote speech, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Artificial Intelligence. The TCF session recordings, the program grid, and the program guide are free and available for download on the website tcf-nj.org. Donations are welcome to offset expenses. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the computer club. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, May the 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Jitsi Meet. Website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation with an interview with a podcaster. Thursday, May the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Website is nyacc.org. Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, May the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. And the website is limac.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on dazzling dinners through technology and culinary creativity. Thursday, May the 27th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is bcug.com. The Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, June the 3rd. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is wpcug.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.